Sacramento Bureau Chief John Myers has more.
The new Public Policy Institute of California poll suggests most of those surveyed would flunk a course in California civics and budgeting. Even though 64% support more infrastructure bonds to be sold, a plan pitched by Governor Schwarzenegger, 52% admit they know little or nothing about how bonds are paid for.
They don't really know how the bonds work in terms of a financing tool in California.
Pollster Mark Baldessari says that means voters don't understand bonds are long-term borrowing that the state must pay back with interest to Wall Street investors. Estimates are the state now spends as much or more on paying back bonds as it does on the entire University of California system. The poll also finds more than half of those surveyed think either prisons or social services are the largest state expenditures, but it's really K-12 education.
I think that tells you, you know, basically that these discussions that are going on right now about whether we should spend more in one area or another, or do we have enough revenues coming in, for most of the people in California, it's not something that really resonates with them.
That fact in itself would be troubling, but pollster Baldessari says it's particularly ominous in California because so many public policy decisions about where and how to spend tax dollars are made not by lawmakers at the state capitol, but by citizens through initiatives at the ballot box. For the California Report, I'm John Myers in Sacramento.
Under a deal struck in the legislature earlier this month, the state will spend nearly $8 billion to build new prison beds. California already spends far more than any other state on prisons, and still inmates are crammed into any available space. Federal judges are threatening to take over the system because it's so crowded. As Judy Campbell reports, one would think California was in the middle of an enormous crime wave, but we're not.
In California, as in most of the country, crime rates have been falling since 1991.
Then we had, in the 9 years after 1991, a period of time when a correctional populations defied gravity.
Bolt Law professor Franklin Zimmering has written a book about declining crime rates.
Crime went down every year after 1991, virtually all over the United States, while correctional populations kept going up.
Currently, there are about 172,000 people in California prisons, add in county jails, and it's more than 250,000 incarcerated. That's roughly the size of Buffalo, New York. Part of the prison growth just reflects a rise in the state population. But Zimmering says that only accounts for some of it.
The transition in the 1990s was from lock 'em up to throw away the key.
California adopted three strikes, two strikes, and mandatory minimum sentences. Barry Crisberg heads the National Council on Crime and Delinquency in Oakland.
Overall, what we've seen in the last 30 years has been over 1,000 bills designed to increase prison terms.
Some of the longer sentences were necessary, says Crisberg. Others didn't make as much sense for public safety.
We have a lot of really silly laws. I mean, you know, petty theft with a prior petty theft, mandatory incarceration. That was because the credit card companies, you know, lobbied for that. It makes no sense. I mean, I want my prisons prioritized for violent, serious offenders. I think we could think about something else to do with people who commit credit card fraud.
In fact, about half of all inmates in California prisons today are in for nonviolent offenses. Many of these are short-term commitments. Barry Crisberg points out that more than half of new prison admissions are for inmates who weren't charged with a new crime, but rather violated the terms of their parole. The result, he says, a crowded system that doesn't accurately reflect crime rates or risks of offense. Secretary of Corrections James Tilton agrees that there are inmates in prison who would be better served somewhere else, in jails or with alternative sanctions. And Tilton says the system is not doing the job it should be at preparing people to get out so they stay out.
I walk into the department, see idle inmates, too overcrowded, and we have this revolving door. People think they go to prison and aren't coming back. And when walking around the state describing the current environment, not all inmates, but a significant number have come back out of the prison system with $200 and no skills. And we're surprised that we have a 70% recidivism rate.
What will help, he says, is the governor's new building plan that attaches reentry and rehabilitation services to new beds. Tilton says his goal is to make the prison system smarter, not necessarily to reduce the population.
That would put people on the streets at risk. And so my responsibility is to build prisons, operate them safely for those that belong in the prison system, but also provide other alternatives. And so I think that's the challenge for me, is how do I change this system so that we don't just warehouse them and keep them behind bars and then put them back on the streets, but we actually impact this population and make them more successful.
Nonetheless, Tilton says part of the reason crime rates have gone down is because criminals have been caught and a lot of them are in prison. But Michael Jacobson with the National Justice Policy Organization, the Vera Institute, says high prison populations don't always correlate with reduced crime rates. He points to the example of New York. Crime there fell at more than double rates around the country, and prison populations have declined. The lesson?
It is possible to drop your prison population. To drop it, not just stabilize it, to drop it, and also make huge reductions in crime at the same time. I think that's a very important story, both for the public and for politicians and policymakers. You know, you don't have to keep growing your prison system in order to protect public safety. And if you don't have to, I'm not sure why you would.
California lawmakers say they had to approve the money for new prison beds to keep federal judges from taking over the system. But even lawmakers that brokered the deal say they're holding out for real changes that address the root causes of overcrowding, parole, and sentencing policies. For the California Report, I'm Judy Campbell.
That's the California Report for Thursday, May 31st, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Penny Nelson. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California, and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. AARP and its more than 3 million California members working to ensure access to affordable, quality health care for all Californians. Online at aarp.org. And the California Healthcare Foundation and Cal Hospital Compare, a new website rating hospital quality in California at calhospitalcompare.org.
The preceding portion of the California Report in the Evening News has been brought to you by the Mendocino County Public Health Branch, and also the preceding portion has been brought to you by the Willett Center for the Arts and, of course, our members. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, K201HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg, and KZYX.org on the World Wide Web. Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. It's 7 o'clock and time for Education Now. I'm your host, Athena Melville, and we're not going to have our regular music tonight on Education Now because Marlene Barron comes with her own music. Tonight, we'll hear an address by Dr. Marlene Barron, who's a professor at New York University. She is a strong proponent of parent-teacher partnerships, helping teachers and parents better understand how to work together to support children and children's development. And I'm so glad that you're with me. Professor Barron gave this address to the 100th centennial conference this past March in New York, along with Christopher Dodds, who we heard last week, and of course Sweet Honey in the Rock was there, and so was Maya Angelou, and and they had a great time. And as well as being a professor of education, she's been a Montessori teacher. Dr. Barron has been a Montessori teacher for 30 years. She travels the world observing schools and giving feedback. She's going to be introduced to us tonight by the singers from Springfield, and we'll stop when she spills the water on her computer. We'll stop her address. It's going to run about 44 minutes, so let's get started. And welcome to Education Now. Here we go.
Thank you on behalf of Los Plenaros de la 21. Have a wonderful evening with Dr. Marilyn Barron. Thank you. God bless you.
Now that's the way to begin a conference. This is our 100th anniversary conference, and we begin with a dazzling, electrifying group, and I always wanted to be a Broadway dancer. And I got it. I also really thought about that maybe tonight I'll be Fidel Castro and go on and on and on. However, Forrest Sawyer managed to have me cut down the talk so we can go home and we can go to dinner and we can go out partying. So this weekend, this tonight, is our time to begin our celebration. And we're celebrating those who came before us. And we are going to resolve this weekend to be as glorious as they were. Maria Montessori was a radical. She was a feminist. She was a social reformer. She was a visionary. She rethought and thought about education. She imagined and reimagined a new world. She reinvented education. Nancy McCormick Rambush also was a social reformer who rethought and thought about education and imagined a new world. Nancy also gave us diversity, the notion that Montessori might look different in different places. When she brought Montessori to the United States, she thought that she needed to make Montessori fit the American culture. And without her, we would not be here. Who knows who would be here, but we wouldn't be. These women thought and rethought, imagined and reimagined. Nancy 50 years ago, Maria Montessori 100 years ago. And now it's time for us to think, rethink, imagine, and envision. We've been doing, but have we been thinking enough as we've been doing? Tonight I'm going to throw out a lot of questions. I'm going to get you guys thinking. As people who know me know, I have lots of questions. I might not have the answers. And tonight we can begin to uncover and to work towards the possibilities for our future. Can you imagine the world in 100 years? Wait a minute.
We don't even know what the world was like 100 years ago. How can we imagine 100 years from now? We act sometimes as though we are amnesiacs in a strange place with no idea as to how we got here. Do we know our past, our multiple past, and I'm talking about our Montessori past, and how these events shaped us? Our past produced our present. Our present is always reinventing our past. You can't get rid of the baggage of the past. But let's talk about 100 years ago. 100 years ago when Montessori was inventing and reinventing and thinking and rethinking. But I don't know 100 years in Italy, but I could find out about 100 years ago in the United States. The one that's so interesting to me is the fact that most women wash their hair once a month and use Borax, or egg yolks for shampoo. And when I told that, Mingma said that in Nepal, women washed their hair 100 years ago once a year. Listen, when I finished years ago, when I was young, you took a bath once a week. Friday night, you took a bath once a week. Also, a couple other little, you know, that golden past people talk about in the United States. Well, I don't know how golden it was, but I like paragraph 3. Marijuana, heroin, and morphine were all available over the counter at the local corner drugstore. That's why it was golden, guys. Well, I mean, everyone knew heroin clears the complexion, gives buoyancy to the mind, regulates the stomach and bowels, and is in fact a perfect guardian of health. Now, I wonder in Maria's days in Italy what they were thinking. So if we can't imagine, if we didn't even know about some of this, what is it going to be like in 100 years? You know, it really does stagger the mind. We also need to rethink to get a better perspective on the past. Do you get that? Take a look at that. In case you can't read, it says, of course, it's still a complete mystery as to how the ancients even managed to move these massive stones. Yeah, we all have ideas about what it was like, but I'm not so sure we know. But most important, it's the time now to rethink, to imagine for the next 50 years, the next 100 years, and we need to focus on goals. We need to focus on where we're going, and we have to stop focusing on all the problems. Only, I believe, when we discover and we see our past can we imagine the future. We have to stand on the shoulders of Maria Montessori and Nancy Rambusch and think about our past, think about our present, our multiple presents, who we are, tell our stories, share in conversations so that we can imagine the next 50 years, the next 100 years. And then when you think about that future, while I cannot predict the future, I do know that the future is going to be very different. We're now into that postmodern world. And people say, what's the postmodern world? Well, I have discovered, by the way, that I'm locked into this position. Normally, I would run around on the stage, but I somehow can't get this off. It's truly locked in. So I'm going to have to point instead of run. All right, everybody in this room who was born before 1940, raise your hand. All right, we were born and raised in the modern world. Oops. Those of you who were born after 1970, raise your hand. Oh, the such young ones. You guys were born and raised in the postmodern world. Guess what? We're very different. Very different. And in the postmodern world, changes are happening fast. Very, 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 very fast. What is cutting edge today is out of date in 6 months. Now, in this postmodern world, we're faced with lots of contradictions. When I grew up, there was one truth. Whatever your religion was the truth. That was the truth, right? There was no other truth. In school, you might have learned a few other truths, but mainly, you had one truth. Today, the world is complex, multiple truths. There is no truth. There are truths, plural. Everything is complex. Whose news do you listen to? CNBC, Fox News, BBC, BBC International, CNN, or, like me, do you go to Jonathan Stewart, Khobar Report? That's where I get my news. I mean, whose news, whose version of what's going on in the world is the truth? And when you don't know what's the truth, how do you make decisions? How are we helping children to make decisions? There are also shifts intellectually. When I started off as an undergraduate, I ran rats. I was a behaviorist. I had my rat. I ran my rat. I knew all about Skinner, B.F. Skinner, and that was the transmission model of learning. And today, we've shifted, and we know that only works short-term, that we think about the constructivist model, and that's Vygotsky. So there's been a roller coaster of theories and theorists, from Skinner to Chomsky. You know the whole story about how Skinner was, you know, one step below, you know, the angels, and then he became like, oh my God, who? Skinner? He wrote a book, a tome, toward the end of his life, and it was on human language learning. And this book was all about how humans learn language. Noam Chomsky in Harvard reviewed the book, and Noam Chomsky said, "What a brilliant book, Skinner." He wrote this. "This is a brilliant book. You did so much research about human language learning on rats and mice and chickens. Did you ever think about looking at a human?" And that's why when Piaget came on the scene at that point, it was like, my God, someone looked at children. Might have been just two, but he looked at children. And then this is not a child development course that some of you know I love to teach, but, you know, as we move forward, we're now into the world of Vygotsky. And when I was running rats, I believed that knowledge could be taught through direct instruction. Sit down and learn this, kid. And if you don't learn it, it's your fault. Today, we know that humans construct their knowledge and understanding. Montessori knew this. Montessori knew this, and Vygotsky wrote about Montessori. Don't forget that. And I don't know if she knew about him, but he knew about her. When I was running rats, I thought that learning was something you did alone, sort of in the phone booth, and the metaphorical phone booth. And today we know learning takes place in a social setting. You need others around you, and that's how we learn. We learn how to be humans. And Montessori also knew that. Today, as Montessorians, what I wonder about is, have we lost our focus? Remember, constructivists focus on how children learn, how they learn. Are we doing research and looking at how our children, today's children, the postmodern children, the TV generation children, the children who don't ever sit and look out a window, but they sit with these things and they sit with in cars, you know, in straitjackets called car seats for hours a day, and city children sit in strollers for hours a day. God forbid children should roll around and run around and do anything. They're being forced to sit still. And they're getting programmed. They're getting a lot of information sort of dumped on them visually and auditorially. But are we looking about how children learn? Are we looking at the ways to support learning, our teaching strategies? Montessori was brilliant. She thought about all these strategies, designing work, putting work out so it's available to children, the presentation, the idea of the presentation, how to introduce children to materials, the idea that every material dances a developmental ladder. All of those are brilliant ideas. But are we talking about them? Are we looking at that? Or have we lost our focus? And are we examining our beliefs? Our beliefs. Our beliefs about boys and girls? You know, when I was young, everybody knew that girls were not good in math. You just weren't good in math. I don't know, something about the brain. The girls were not good in math. And I was good in math. And I have to tell you, in lower elementary, I struggled. I said, all right, I'm good in math and I love math. Maybe I'm not a girl. Remember, this is in the 40s. I didn't know what the kids know today. I didn't know until I went to college what the kids in our classes know today. Thank goodness for that health ed course in college. Woo! And the other thing was, well, maybe I'm really not good in math. I just have been lucky. They call that the Cinderella complex. People have written about it, where girls cannot believe that they're good in something because everyone knows girls are not good in math, and therefore they think they're lucky and they're waiting for, you know, something to be hard, something, you know, not to do well on, where they say, see, I knew I wasn't good in this. But what do we know about boys and girls? How do you greet children in the morning? Oh, I like the way you did your hair. Or, do you open up, have you done research on how you just greet children in the morning? I bet you'd be surprised. Also, there are differences between boys and girls. Do you know what they are? What do you think about math? What are your beliefs about math? We don't talk about this enough. I mean, is math about, we know that math is not about the right answer, don't we? And about, say, parents. I'm going to get back to parents in a minute. But it's not only our beliefs that we need to look at and look at in light of what Montessori had to say about these things, but it's also in the fact that we're with different children, our brains are different. It's not, I mean, when I say where children are different, girls are hitting puberty at the age of 8. My mother's generation, it was 16. Yeah, there's stuff in the food, and yeah, they're getting hormones, and yeah. But if it's happening physically, it's also happening here physically. And while we want to green the planet, we still have these children in our classrooms. So it's not only our beliefs, but it's also what it's called the deep structure constructs that underneath, that undergird our beliefs. Now, your beliefs you can talk about. All right, we can have conversations about beliefs, and you can look at some evidence and research and do your own research. But the deep structure ones, they're way underneath. They're invisible. And let's look at some of them, because we need to make them visible because we need to go forward into the next 100 years. One of the beliefs that Montessorians, one of the structure, deep structure constructs that we suffer from, is our search for perfection. We want an ideal classroom. We want to design the perfect classroom. Every material should be gorgeous and colors match, and every inch of it be perfect. In fact, we design museum classrooms, and then those kids come in and mess it up. But real learning, true learning, involves mess and flow, and it's really hard to give up that, I want it to be perfect. The search for perfection, that's a hard one. That's also one that we're being sold all the time. It's all about marketing. Buy this and you will look perfect. Your hair will be perfect. Your teeth will be perfect. Your nails will be perfect. Your body will be perfect. It's all about marketing you to be gorgeous and perfect. So we're being sold that. You know, Maria Montessori was not being sold that over and over and over again. We have another deep structure construct that comes in the postmodern world is the fact that you have to just, you know, face reality. You can never complete a project. It's never over. You just stop. It's impossible to wrap it up and finish it. You can't have a 3-6 kid wrapped up and finished for the 6-9 class. You can't have a 6-9 child wrapped up and finished for the next level. It just can't happen. You know, but we all want it to happen. We want to just wrap it up. It feels good when you can put it away. Well, part of it is to say, it's not finished. I'm just stopping. The other one is, in the modern world, and the world that Maria Montessori and Nancy Rambusch, by the way, sort of worked in, grew up in, and worked in, is a world that was very linear. It's about books. You start at page one, page two, page three, page four, and you go through the book. And it's all about dun, da, dun, da, dun, da, dun. Well, today, that ain't the world, guys. It's now all about simultaneity. It's the internet. You are one click away from everything. It's all happening at once. You can watch the latest war, the latest revolution, the latest anything, the latest surgery, the latest, you name it, you know, right now on somebody's webcam, anywhere. So it's all happening at once. We used to, and a few schools have begun looking at the idea of finish one work, one activity before doing the next one, that's so unrealistic. Nobody here does that. You couldn't live if you did that. You can't. It's impossible. We all manage multiple tasks. So why are we trying to get our kids to live in a modern, linear world when they go home to a postmodern world? They go home where everything is happening all at once. What does that mean in our classrooms? How are we going to think about this? And it's going to happen faster and faster because those webcams are creating experience. They're not just documenting it, they're creating it. So it's all about that simultaneity. And of course, there's more and more and more and more stuff, but what do you need to know? What do you need to know? How do I move this forward? Okay, there we go. Okay, what you need to know, and we need to talk about this, and we need to think about this, and we need to write about this, is we need to know more about current research, human development from a constructivist perspective. What does it mean that these kids are sitting for hours in car seats and strollers? What does it mean that they're not outside anymore? What does that mean in terms of their knowing where their bodies are in space? Because if you don't know where your body is in space, if you can't roll around like a puppy dog or a bear cub, then that's all about math. You don't know where, understand math. That's sort of a basic organic development that will lead to your understanding math, because math is all about moving objects in space. So we need to know more about this. We also need to know, I think teachers need to know more about development in content areas. You know, once we stopped looking at and running rats and start looking at humans, we learned a lot about how children learn to read, to write, numeracy, social behaviors. I had a great, some research I read, it took place, it was from a sociologist, and she looked at, she had all her graduate students look at classrooms and sit and take notes. So every chapter in her book is about some of their research, and that's what we should be doing in the teacher education programs, guys. But so they went out. So one of the things, and when the researchers went in the room, they became known as lesser adults. That means unless it was life-threatening, They would not make, you know, any facial expressions or say anything. And what did they discover? There's never been a water table in a classroom or outside in a playground that children haven't spit in. They look around, don't see a teacher, they spit. And if you have boys and you have a playground, you know what they do. It's male bonding. And you can't stop it, and it happens. They also noticed, I mean, so those are some of the things which I thought, oh, of course. Now, they also noticed how children enter a classroom across different, you know, these were mainly childcare programs in Canada and in northern New York State. How children enter a classroom. We don't document enough. We need to do that if we're going to be around in 50 years and 100 years. We need to better understand what's happening in our classrooms. I also think we need to look at our teaching strategies and think, are we really optimizing what the strategies that Maria Montessori enabled us to understand? For example, I'll come back to that too. The other thing we have to understand is the difference between concepts, skills, and dispositions. Because we can't talk about what's going on in our classrooms if we mix this all up. Okay, skills. Cutting with a scissor, riding a bicycle, penmanship. If you have an intact body capable of the skill, everybody can learn it. Everyone improves with practice. Your rate of improvement with practice is determined by your physiology. So a two-month-old cannot ride a unicycle, all right? Okay, that's a skill. Practice, you get better. Concepts, are they attained? Think of Piaget's conservations. Think of seriation. Think of subitizing. You don't know what subitizing is? Ask Peggy Leffler. She's in the back. She'll tell you what subitizing is. But concepts can't be taught. You can give children experiences to help attain concepts, but you can't teach seriation. And dispositions are ways of being in the world. One of my licensing people, Sandra Smith, and I used to have these long conversations about the fact that children learn how to be humans by watching the adults in their classrooms and in their homes. And since many of our children are in school 6 and 8 hours, they're with us a lot, and they're watching the adults in the classrooms. Not what the adults say, but what they really do. And if you have a depressed adult, that's what children are learning. That's what adults are. They walk around like this, and they don't smile much. So if they're around adults that have a sense of humor, hey, they learn that humor is something what adults do. We tell jokes. We have fun. We smile at people. Those are dispositions. Wait a minute. Let's stop. I forgot. Go back. Goals. Goals. Another thing we have to talk about, goals. Goals of education. Whose goals of education do you support? Do we agree on the goals of education? Yeah, everyone will agree on, say, the first goal, which is moral education, character development, peace education, that we want children to be moral. They would agree on that. But then there are other ones, other goals of education. And each of these goals come from a significant educator, historically and currently. Each of these goals, some politician is pushing and trying to get funded. And each of these goals underpins what your parents want for their children. And then, of course, once we can decide what goals, what are practices are most appropriate for which goals? Wait a minute, let's look at a goal or two so you know what I'm talking about. Okay, let's look problem solvers. I've took ones that I know everyone probably would agree with. Do we want kids to be problem solvers? Well, we know that in the future, it's not what you know, but it's how you tackle a problem that's probably going to be the most successful to have, a characteristic to have. Because we don't know what the world's going to be like, but if you can problem solve, you can figure it out. So, if we only allow children to use material after a presentation, we're really saying, you can't figure it out. You need me to show you, and you better do it the way I showed you or else. We're nicer than that, but you know what I mean. Or do we allow children to figure it out? Now, I always think of it respectfully, figure it out, not throw it against the wall and bounce it, you know, but to figure it out. Do we trust them to figure it out? Do they become problem solvers in our classroom? Or do we keep them from problem solving? And one of the teachers, Donna, one of my teachers, does presentations. I don't know if you're doing it here. Donna, are you doing it here? No. Okay. But she's done it at other AMS conferences where she talks about, she took out some technology out of the classroom. She took out scissors, and we're talking with the children about it, and she took out tape, masking tape, scotch tape. And, you know, they talked about, well, how do you cut things then? They figured out lots of ways. How do you attach things? Children who were racing through stuff really stopped because this, you know, the technology in some way took away from their ability to problem solve. And we need to think about that. And I think that's what Maria Montessori did when she created her classrooms 100 years ago.
This is KZYX. You're listening to Education Now and Dr. Marlene Barron.
Active citizens in a democracy. How do we work with others without clear lines of authority? I mean, look at what happened in some parts of the world when there are no clear lines of authority. How do you work that way? Now, let me give you an idea. In a classroom, you have a group, and in the group, children often raise their hand. Well, why do we raise our hands? That is so bizarre. The only place you do that is in the classroom. It's such a teacher-school thing. So I was reading some research in England, and there was this teacher who decided she wasn't going to have her kids raising the hand, because when kids are raising hands, it says, I, teacher, I, boss, you can talk because you're sitting with your hands on your lap and your feet crossed. When you sit with your hands on your lap and your feet crossed, then I can call on you. All control. I think that we do it because we love to be in charge. We love to control. All right. So she worked for a whole year. It was a single age grouping of 4-year-olds, and she worked for the whole year on how to create some sort of democratic group where you didn't have to raise your hand. You know, children could take turns, could listen to each other, and you could have conversations. Now, conversations, by the way, are very interesting. Linguistically, they're very interesting. If you don't know the work of Deborah Tannen, you should read Deborah Tannen. She's a brilliant researcher, linguistic researcher, but she also writes popular books like You Just Don't Understand Me, just all kinds of books, you know, she writes. And they're very funny, and she's terrific. And she talks about two kinds of conversational styles. The first style is, and you have this in Northern Europe, you have this in the Midwest, is the wait time partners. I speak, I stop, there's a wait time. How long the wait time, how many nanoseconds or seconds, depends on where you are in the world. And then you speak. You stop, wait time, I speak, I stop. And that's how it goes. That's very nice. However, there are also latchers. Do you know what a latcher is? You speak, You are required to speak until I latch on and start speaking over you, and then you can stop speaking, and then I speak, and I'm required to speak until you latch on to me and start talking. Now, can you imagine when a latcher and a wait time person get married? Persons get married? She says, "You never talk to me. You never talk to me." And he says, "You never shut up and give me a chance to talk." Or vice versa. In fact, Deborah Tannen analyzes the reason that Pat Nixon and Khrushchev's wife did not get along is because Khrushchev's wife said that Pat Nixon was very boring. She never talked. And I had to keep talking and talking. As a Russian, she's a latcher. And Pat Nixon said the woman never shut up. She never stopped talking and gave me a chance, because she was a wait time person. And the other thing to think about, so when wait time people and latchers, now we want our kids to be comfortable. We're in a global society, guys, right? Everything is happening all at once. Everything is happening everywhere. And we want our kids to be comfortable being latchers and being wait time. It's flexibility. You got to move with whatever's happening. So what's polite in one culture might be impolite in another culture. Looking someone in the eye. Children, older people, what's respectful, what's not respectful. The other thing is that people say to me, "But Marlene, they're all going to talk in the same at the same time. They won't hear each other." And I said, "Don't push your culture on me, madam. Because in my culture, we all talk at the same time. And we have no trouble hearing each other." And you get the Mediterraneans, and you get the New Yorkers, and you get the, you know, a little bit, not so much on the West Coast, much more on the Northeast. And so, you know, and indigenous Hawaiians. In fact, I have a video put by some an emergent literacy group. I think it was maybe IRA, but an illiteracy group, IRA. And they show a classroom in Hawaii where the culture is everyone talks in the same time. And guess what? Everyone talks at the same time. Not a problem. And you guys who have to want to do it one at a time, don't push your culture on me. Learn to do it simultaneity. All right, now we have to think about, once we get the goals, what are the practices, which ones get in the way of certain goals? I mean, if we want kids to be problem solvers, I think presentations are important. I'm not saying dump presentations. I'm saying we have to think about it. We do have to think about it and rethink and re-envision. We have to reimagine education. And let's look at one or two practices. We say, and in the privacy of this room of Montessorians, that our curriculum, what's a curriculum, but that's another thing, is based on observations of children. Well, I'm not so sure we're so good in observing children. Are we ethnographers? Have we really learned to observe children? Do you really know what goes on in your classroom? Or do you know what you would like to have happen in your classroom? And you're trying to make it happen, no matter whether these children want to do it or not. And you're going to push them through the curriculum like it's pages of a book. It's not pages of a book. The genius of Montessori was that those materials, as I said, not only dance the developmental ladder, they also are so attractive and interesting that if you let children alone, they do much more with the materials than we could ever think about doing with those materials. We have only uncovered, I think, the tip of the iceberg with what's possible with those materials. And we have to look at that more for the future. We say that we offer choice. Montessori says choice, choice. Children must have choice. I go into more and more classrooms with children. After you do this, you have to do this. And after you do this, you have to do that. They're not given choice. because, and I don't want to hear all the reasons, but they're not given choice. You know, I hear everybody's reasons, the testing and the this thing and the that thing and parents. I don't, okay, let's get into parents. Let's talk about parents. You know, Montessori ran a full day program. All you guys are doing half day 3 to 6 programs or half day 3 to 6 with an extended day by somebody, you're not running Montessori schools. She did a full day Montessori program. She involved parents. People are so surprised when they come to Westside Montessori School because our parents come in the classroom, drop off in the classroom, and hang around, hang about. They watch what happens. They sit there, it's messy and it's a little sloppy and they got their bags around, but, you know, they watch what goes on in the classroom. And to me, that working in partnership with parents rather than educating them at night in workshops or lectures is what we should be all about and is what I think Montessori was about from my reinterpreting our past. Because so many times parents have said to me, and I just what comes to my head is a father who said to me at the end of last year, he said, you know, Marlene, I learned to be a father by dropping off in some mornings and hanging out for 5-10 minutes. I used to watch the teachers. I watched how they talked to children and what they did when one child said this and one child did that. And he said, and you know what? I went home and I tried it. And that language worked. And not only that, I did it on play dates. And it worked there too. He said, I would have never known how to talk with children in a respectful way if I hadn't watched your teachers and had the opportunity to ask your teachers, how come you didn't make that kid do this or share that or do, you know, whatever. And because I was, your techniques, your practices were accessible to me, I began to adopt them. I think we need to think more about working in partnership, not educating parents. Every time I hear parent education, I think, listen, they don't need an education. They know that kid for 3 years, 5 years, 8 years, 10 years, 12 years. We have the kid a year or two, maybe a couple more years in our school. They have a longitudinal 24/7 view of that child. We've got the child with 20, 25 other children, you know, in a prepared environment. Together, we can build around the child and understand children's development. Together, we can make the world better for children. Parent partnerships, that's what should be our language, not parent education. Parent education is so top-down. We don't know enough to, you know, to be able to do that. And then, of course, materials. Yes, any of you know me know I really think a lot that we need to think about all the materials we have in our classroom. Do you have books? Do you know how important storybooks are to children's literacy development? That gets back to what I talked about earlier about understanding literacy. If children are surrounded by people who speak French, they speak French. They're surrounded by people who speak Russian, they speak Russian. If they're surrounded by books, they speak book language and write book language and think book language and fall in love with books. They need to be surrounded by books from the first day. And I'm not worried about this, the fantasy. Listen, they're watching television. They're playing those games. They're not the kids of 100 years ago. We need to help them make the distinction between fantasy and reality. But you know what? BBC, CNBC, Fox News, which is fantasy, which is reality? And I think that teachers, as our practice, we need to be thinkers more. We got to think and not be just manipulators of materials. You know, I just spilt a whole glass of water on my computer.
And we're going to leave it there. She does come back some moments later, but she leaves us with the word Santani, which in Italian means to the next 100 years. I certainly hope that you enjoyed Marlene Baron as much as I enjoyed bringing her to you. She's quite the character, and I'm happy to take your calls at 895-2448 or 1-800-499-7117 if you have any questions about this. I was reminded when I heard this and whenever I think of Montessori of a quote by Gregory Bateson where he says, "Growth is governed by relationships and not the absolutes." And I just think that that's so true. And in the future, I want to really go into the connection between play and intelligence with you, because you know the one of the ways of deciding about intelligence is mammals that play, and those are dolphins and whales and humans and orangutans and bonobos, and so playing is just so important. And and humor, of course. Yes, I really enjoyed bringing Montessori to you. She's one of these women who just doesn't receive the recognition she deserves for everything that she did. Another woman who deserves a lot of recognition for what she did in proving that racism is learned is Josephine Baker. And I don't know if you know about her, but really quite a wonderful woman. Now, next month, on June 21st, here on Education Now, we're going to be talking about youth violence and the arts as containers with Christopher Melville. And so I hope you'll tune in. It should be very, very exciting. I'll be doing two workshops through the city of Ukiah. They're six-week workshops, empowerment workshops for parents, a parent-child growth workshop, and a parent empowerment workshops. If you're interested in those, they're starting on the 25th. They'll run 6 weeks on Monday evenings, and you can register through the city of Ukiah. I want to tell you that the Google guys credit Montessori for their success. They were Montessori guys, and all of that interconnectedness they claim, you know, that's where it comes from, which I can totally understand. I want to thank Marcy Craver at AMS headquarters for her support and help in getting me this address by Marlene Baron and the address by Christopher Dodds. I want to thank the staff here at KZYX and Z, and of course our listeners and who make it possible for us to do this radio and have this wonderful radio station. And I wanted to also give you some promos here before we use up our time. The Tree of Life Montessori Charter School is having a summer program. It starts on June 25th and runs through July 27th. They're 1 week. 1 week. You can sign up for 1 week or several weeks. It's in Ukiah. The Tree of Life Montessori Charter School is in Ukiah. They'll be having a summer program. There will be an integrated curriculum, including music, sports, art, drama, core subjects, and environmental education. You can call 462-0913 and ask for Rhonda. That's 462-0913 and ask for Rhonda. Something else that's happening here at Ukiah High School, a red carpet affair with a Ukiah High School art show Saturday, June 2nd from 4 to 8 p.m. At the Grace Hudson Museum Meeting Room. Call 453-5253, extension 1167. For more information, and the contact name is Pilar Crocs. Once again, that's the Ukiah High School is the sponsor of a red carpet affair, the Ukiah High School Art Show. That should be quite wonderful, I would think. And there's so many wonderful things happening in our community, and I'm really looking forward to talking to you about the arts and next month. And the AV Adult School is having a dance concert at the Boonville Big Band Saturday, June 2nd at 9 p.m. at Lawrence Cafe. So that's a dance concert pardon me, the Boonville Big Band at for the Anderson Valley Adult School, Saturday, June 2nd at 9 p.m. at Lawrence. Now, about what's going on here at the station tomorrow, the Access Program tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., the subject is water. There's simply not enough of it. The future of Mendocino County depends upon it. Supervisor Pinches says he has an answer for it. Does he? Can it work? And is it affordable? That's what we want to know. Is it affordable? Friday at 9 a.m., Supervisor Pinches will be on the phone, and Terry Jo Barber, hydrologist, will be in the studio with Norman Duvall. So tune in tomorrow morning at 9. And then tomorrow, Friday at 1 p.m., Corporations and Democracy, they celebrate localization this Friday with Jim Tarbell and Linda Perry. They'll talk to Celine Rice from the Post Carbon Institute, which assists communities to relocalize their economies and deal with the coming energy crunch. Then they'll talk with Caitlin Soapy Belknap from the National Conference of Bali, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies, which is taking place at UC Berkeley this weekend. For the last half of the show, they will be previewing the goals for turning the Mendocino Coast into a localized economy as they review the new goals of SAIL in anticipation of their event Friday night at Fort Bragg Town Hall. Join them on Corporations and Democracy, they say, this Friday to become part of the localization effort that is sweeping the world. How exciting. So that's what's happening here on KZYX and Z. Coming up at 8 o'clock will be the Treehouse, of course, with W. Dan. And then after that, we'll be, dead with probably Roberto Muerto, that wonderful guy. So, as I said, next week we'll be talking about next month on the 21st of June, here on Education Now, we'll be talking about youth violence and the arts as containers with my in-house guest, Christopher Melville. So do join me for that. It's going to be a lot of fun. And I would like to especially thank the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education for producing this show. I couldn't do it without them. And, of course, I want to thank all of the staff here at KZYX and Z for their support, as well as Roberto Muerto, who helps me here, and Annie, when I come once a month. It's a lot different, and I do need help, so I really appreciate it from all of them. And I want to thank all of you listeners for supporting this radio station and all of our underwriters. You know, we just couldn't do it without you. Now, if you have some ideas for what you'd like to hear on our show, there's a lot of great things coming up on Education Now. I have some great shows in the works because there's a lot of things happening in education. And one of the things that we'll be discussing in June with Christopher on youth violence, I got a letter from the Alliance for Childhood, and it's quite... quite disgusting and scary. It says, this is the Alliance for Childhood in its call to action on the education of young children included this statement. Because what happened was that at an elementary school in Florida, it made the national news recently by calling the police to arrest a kindergartner, Desiree Watson, for throwing a flailing, kicking tantrum. Desiree was handcuffed, charged with a felony, battery on a school official, fingerprinted, and taken to jail. When Bob Herbert of the New York Times, interviewing the police chief, said, "But she was six," the chief replied, "Do you think this is the first six-year-old we've arrested?" Most school administrators find alternatives to calling the police when a young child becomes violent, but the problem of kindergarten rage is getting worse. So we're going to be tackling that. What is driving these kids to rage and tantrums and violent outbursts? We will address that. And what the Alliance for Childhood is saying is that these kids are being tested, and they're sitting in their seats with no recess, and they're preparing to be tested, and then they're being tested, and there's no recess, there's no free time. There's nothing like what we remember. And that's the Alliance for Childhood, www.allianceforchildhood.org. I hope you'll check that out. I know you'll find it interesting. If you want to connect with me personally, it's Hermes, H-E-R-M-E-S, at pacific.net. And of course, this show and all of the other shows that have been here on Education Now have been put up on my website where you can go to listen to them or download them. It's www.pacificsites, pacificsites.com/TildaHermes. So I hope you'll go there and check us out. And I hope if you're interested in a parent-child workshops or a parent empowerment workshop that you'll check with the City of Ukiah, just go there and register for the class. They're going to be small classes. And I'd love to see you there. And thank you so much for listening to Education Now. This is KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits in Ukiah, K201 HR 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. And it's just about, well, we're just about ready for Earth and Sky. I'm going to give it to you maybe a couple of minutes early, but maybe I shouldn't because I don't see W. Dan's smiling face. Should I give it to them a couple of minutes early, W. Dan?
I'm in the treehouse.
He's in the treehouse. What do you say? Hey, up there in the treehouse, W. Dan. Shall we give it to them a few minutes early? Thanks, everyone, for listening to KZYX and Z. This is a great radio station. I'm going to give you Earth and Sky. Here we go. This time I'm really going to do it. Yes, I'm going to go over to here, and I'm going to Well, why isn't it doing it, Dan? There we go.
Earth and Sky.
Thursday, May 31st, there's a full moon every month, and every full moon has a special name.
When there's a second full moon of a calendar month, it's come to be called a blue moon. But whether you call tonight's full moon a blue moon or give that name to the full moon at the end of next month will depend on where you live on the globe. The full moon reaches the crest of its full phase on June 1st at 1:04 a.m. Universal Time. That's a time used by astronomers, a single time for the whole globe of the Earth.
But for the rest of us, Earth is divided into about 24 separate time zones, so although the